Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
I think we're all searching.
There are some people that think that the media would bias.
Good evening, and welcome to Views of the News, the show that this week will devote some time to two topics we too seldom discuss: advertising, specifically those Super Bowl commercials we've all heard so much about, and the rules of the road in Congress for journalists, documentarians, and you and me. I'm your substitute host, Lee Wilkins, and with me in the Reynolds Journalism Institute studio, our faculty colleague and guest, Margaret Duffy, head of the Journalism School's Strategic Communication Emphasis, and regular panelist Charles Davis, whose intellectual energy focuses on government openness. Listeners and viewers may want to take advantage of the Views blog at kbia.org, particularly if you want to take yet another look at some of the advertisements we'll be discussing. According to the Wall Street Journal, the average Super Bowl ad cost about $3.5 million. With about 111 million of us watching the game, viewership apparently was up from Madonna's halftime performance, that works out to about 3 cents per person. And, according to the Journal, Americans spend about $68 per person on Super Bowl goodies, everything from the food we ate too much of to merchandise. We'll talk about whether it was all worth it, from the ads we liked to the shared themes in multiple spots to the duds. And does all of this effort actually result in sales, which, so I'm told, is one of the goals of advertising? Next, and with a nod to the True False Film Festival, which brought this film to Columbia last year, we'll discuss Gasland director Josh Fox's encounter with a subcommittee of the House of Representatives last week. One of my students actually alerted me to this story, where Fox, whose documentary about the controversial practice of fracking to mine natural gas has resulted in proposed legislation in some states and infuriated some in the natural gas industry. Fox was arrested as he tried to film an otherwise public hearing before a House subcommittee meeting about the practice for a sequel to the first documentary. Of course, because it's Congress, it's more complicated than that brief summary, and we'll discuss what all those complications mean for public access to the process. Finally, we'll take some time to analyze and comment on President Obama's reversal of an election year policy to shun super PACs. The president announced earlier this week that he would take advantage of the Citizens United decision in his own election contest. We'll talk about what that will mean, particularly in Missouri with its history as a swing state, in the coming months. But let's begin with those Super Bowl ads. In preparation for today's show, I asked everyone to let me know some of their favorites, and one of those that you, as it turned out, Margaret didn't select, I selected it, was the Pepsi ad featuring Elton John. For those who are watching, here's a brief clip of the ad itself.
It's getting hot in here, so take off all your clothes.
Enough! No Pepsi for you. And what do you do?
I sing.
All I'm asking is for a little respect, 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 back, 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 back. R-E-S-P-E-C-T, find out what it means to me.
All right. Pepsi for you.
No. Pepsi for all.
Yeah, boy!
Margaret, I know as a scholar, you spent a lot of time thinking about culture. So I'm wondering if the cultural content in this commercial was one of the things that made it appealing or unappealing.
Well, as we're fond of saying, good ads sell stuff. And if it is not entirely clear whether this ad is going to be selling stuff, this year it's all about social media. And that's why we had a Super Bowl almost with no surprises. For instance, Ferris Bueller, the Honda commercial, and the Seinfeld commercials were, and I looked these up, among the top those receiving social media counts.
Charles, how, did you see these ads first on social media, on the news? I actually saw some of them on the news and then went to social media to look them
certainly
up.
Certainly the Volkswagen spots. I think we all saw on social media long before we saw them on television. Some of the social media spots, of course, didn't run during the game. They ran before, not during the game, and now are running after, which is I mean, I think that's fascinating, Margaret, because it's kind of this – it's the ad as narrative that's going to be wound before, during, and after an event like the Super Bowl.
Well, and that, of course, is all about the money, because you get with all that expense, you get more impressions for your buck. And, for instance, the remember Little Darth from a year ago? Mm-hmm. Which was the Force, which was very successful.
This was the little kid who goes out and he's trying to do the Star Wars thing, and his parents see him through the front window. So he starts the car, only really it's Dad with the key.
Well, it was calculated that produced 120% improvement in sales for Volkswagen. There are lots of intervening variables, but you love that stuff. That's really something.
Well, Charles, in addition to the one that we're going to talk about in a minute, which is the Clint Eastwood ad, of the other ones that you saw, were there any that left an impression on you?
Negatively, yeah. I'm usually very impressed with Anheuser-Busch's, or InBev, I guess, as they're known now, advertising. And I thought they were one of the great, if we were going to say people were winners and losers, I thought their advertising was wholly ineffective. It was sort of a, I don't know what you call it, a history lesson. It included a spot on the end of Prohibition, which had no, I think Margaret would call it a sales proposition. It had absolutely no sales proposition to it. It was just vacuous. I mean, I just didn't get why they were doing that at all.
Well, you should hear the people in the biz talk about this. They're like, what happened to Budweiser advertising? The rescue dog, if you recall that one, mm-hmm. with the dog who really decides to really ramp up his exercise, turned out to be a gigantically successful ad in social media.
Well, Margaret, was that because of the ad itself, or because at the very end of the ad, the dog is pushing yet sort of another spot, you know, this time for rescue dogs and rescue animals? And I sort of wondered about Pepsi sort of, if you will, hooking the wagon to that sort of nonprofit, let's do good here kind of thing, whether that diminished their message or actually helped it.
Pepsi has at least a recent history of trying to connect with good works, such as in the Pepsi Refresh campaign and other similar ones like that. To me, it looked kind of like an afterthought, but it was an appealing commercial, and I think that's one that's going to get replay. I don't know if the Help the Rescue Dogs is going to be much of a difference.
The other dog on the diet spot was, a Volkswagen spot.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That was also brilliant,
yep.
I thought. I've only seen it the once on television, but I thought it was a great spot.
Well, another one that, again, shortly after the Earth's crust cooled, which is when I took my first and only advertising course, one of the things they sort of drummed into us was that you never mention the competition. So then there was that what I thought was a remarkable Chevy ad, which was sort of the post-apocalyptic Chevy ad, where everybody who has a Chevy truck actually makes it to the rendezvous, except this one poor guy who's driving a Ford. The thing was that Chevy actually mentioned Ford in the commercial, and as I understand it, there was some real pushback from Ford on that one.
Ford was very cranky about that particular situation. You should take it down immediately. But the thing is, they'll drum it into you from time to time that it's advertising is hard. You should never mention the competition. Comparison ads sell. So it really is, it depends. It depends on the product, the situation. Sometimes you're better off talking about the competition and how much better you are.
Well, and notice they talked about it obliquely, right? They didn't say the words Ford. They said the other brand or something.
Well, I think they said Ford.
I think they said
Jim drove a Ford.
See, and I didn't hear it.
So
that's the problem we have is you won't pay attention to our ads.
I was probably looking at a laptop right about that.
You were.
And that, of course, is reflective of most of what we saw in the Super Bowl, which is their recognition now that a good proportion of the people they are trying to reach are either looking at a phone or a laptop, and they're They're engaged in social networking during the advertising.
Well, and in fact, there were a number, I don't know exactly how many, but a number of Super Bowl ads that were designed to get you to engage with social media so you could get coupons or bargains or whatever else that was.
Chevy had one. Audi had a hashtag, which is like Stop Vampires Now or something for Twitter. So, yeah, that kind of engagement device is really crucial, and we're going to see more and more of it. Some of it, I thought the Chevy app was actually a little lame, but they're trying to figure this out, and it's new days in this.
Well, so Margaret, do you think the social engagement works, or is it really so new days that we can't tell? I mean, how much does this help us sell stuff versus how much does this make us happy that we're sitting on the couch waiting for the second half to start?
Well, the thing about it is we now have so much more access to data and analytics and understanding how people are behaving, how they're sharing these things. We do have also a lot of data on the idea that engagement really does increase brand awareness. If you're buying a big ticket item like a car, you're not going to say, oh, I must buy a car. But you think, well, maybe I should put this car into my consideration set. And so that's kind of what our goal is in the what we call the purchase tunnel.
Well, Charles, I know that you told me earlier that you were on social media about a particular ad, and I've got to admit that when I was watching what I'm going to call the Clint Eastwood ad, although that's not what it was at all, I had a lot of reactions to it, including the first one, which I guess was kind of yours, which is I wanted to know what political candidate was paying for it. This is the ad, and I think that was the ad started at the halftime of the Super Bowl. So actually, we don't have a lot of analytics on it because of when it was. It was 2 minutes long, and it has become now the focus of a print media campaign that appeared in USA Today and a couple of other, you know, full-page, big, expensive spreads to carry it forward. But having said that, I'm wondering if Charles, what were you thinking as you were watching that ad? And if we have a bit, we'll play a little clip of it.
Well, my Facebook post immediately after it ended, and I had a moment to
which
ruminate.
I saw.
It was something to the effect of, nice re-elect Obama ad. Was that his super PAC? In which a lot of people wrote in and went, I know, I was totally confused because it was. And I do think it's a really interesting spot in that it borders on the political. While I'm not at all sure that was their intention. I mean, I don't know how that many people could have missed the underlying political message, but sometimes people are so focused on one mission, selling things, that they might have lost track of the narrative there
a
bit.
Charles, we've got a little clip of it, so we're going to play. Now, this is the last 20 seconds of what was a two-minute ad. Then we can come back and talk about it a bit.
This country can't be knocked out with one punch. We get right back up again, and when we do, the world's going to hear the roar of our engines. Yeah, it's halftime, America. And our second half's about to begin.
Okay, Charles, so the first thing that happened to me was I'm so dumb that I had to wait to see the tagline imported from Detroit to understand that this was really a car ad because I was going down a whole different path for the whole 2 minutes. So talk to us a little bit about, you know, how you sort of decoded it. You probably tumbled to it a lot earlier than I did.
Yeah, I was there pretty early. I think there was some oblique reference to Detroit, which made me go, oh, auto. I can't remember what it was. I don't know. It just had some of the trappings of an auto ad. There was some steel imagery, that kind of thing. But I did find it to just be sort of a we're not dead yet manifesto and an exaltation of the bailout of General Motors in no uncertain terms. And so it was so close. And I think this is probably another golden rule of advertising. I'm not sure, but probably avoiding the political if you're not a political ad is probably one of those rules because you don't want to eliminate, in this country these days, 50% of the audience from your message.
Well, Republican strategist Karl Rove had the same reaction you did.
Yes. Yeah. Karl Rove and I saw the ad very similar.
And I've never thought I would hear Charles Davis and Karl Rove agreed on something.
Nor I.
However, I really don't think that was their intention. No. I think it was very similar to the kind of sort of celebratory thing they did with Eminem last year, which was based on the same kind of Detroit's coming back and it's my hometown. But, you know, it certainly is interesting to see how this polarizing political climate really brings out everybody's feelings about this. And Karl Rove actually didn't bring up that, you know, which president actually began the bailouts. That would be George W. Bush, who was defending those bailouts yesterday.
Well, one of the things I thought was interesting, because in preparation for this show, I went back and looked at a whole bunch of ads, and that theme of America is not out yet, or we are recovering, or, you know, that sort of – that this was not the only ad to play on that theme. And I also thought it benefited from just sheer dumb luck of being in halftime in what was an incredibly close game. So, you know, you've got all this, oh, we're in our second half. Well, everybody's waiting in the football game to see what's going on. So we don't often get, I think, a good illustration of what a media echo chamber really looks like, but I thought in that one ad they captured an awful lot of it.
Well, one thing I thought, and maybe this shows I spend too much time thinking about advertising and politics, is it's halftime in America, and I thought it's morning in America.
Yes.
Which is the famous Ronald Reagan, very positive, pro-America, shining city on the hill kind of advertising.
And, of course, using Madonna as the halftime show, well, halftime for Madonna as well. So it appeals to that middle-aged 80s nostalgia that we're all engaging in, at least old folks like me are engaging in. I also was struck by the fact there was an incredibly boring ad by GE about wind, the manufacturing wind turbines. And about two-thirds of the way through that ad, I've been meaning to ask you about this, Margaret, they tie in by saying we're building wind turbines for Budweiser, and suddenly people are lifting beers in a bar. And I thought, wow, did Budweiser pay to insert product in an NBC ad? GE, which owns the network that the Super Bowl was playing.
I am sure there were gigantic negotiations, and yes, but I love the logical premise that thanks to these turbines, you can have a beer.
Your beer's cold.
Well, on that note, whatever note that was, we'll move from the Super Bowl to the halls of Congress, which I guess is a metaphor of some sort, although, again, I'm a little not sure about what that was. Last week, Josh Fox, the director of the documentary film Gasland, which was shown at True Faults and nominated for an Oscar last year, was arrested as he tried to film an otherwise public meeting of the House Subcommittee on Science, Space, Technology, Energy, and the Environment, chaired by Andy Harris, Republican of Maryland. Fox was attempting to film the hearing for Gasland 2, which is about the influence of the fracking industry on Congress. Harris, through a spokesperson, has said that Fox was arrested because he lacked proper credentials, not because of the focus of his film. For some extensive background on fracking, our blog includes a link to an investigative series about the practice entitled Drilling Down that ran in the New York Times over the past several months. That series has also landed the New York Times in some hot water with the oil and gas industry. But Charles, let's start here. If you or I wanted to go to Congress and attend a public hearing, what would we have to do in order to take out our cell phones and film part of the proceedings?
Well, we'd have to have permission and we'd have to be credentialed. And all of that requires, of course, much advance work. And I'm sure he did ask for permission to film, and I'm sure that permission was denied. And I'm sure it was denied in part because of the reputation that he brings to the room. They knew exactly who he was. That sort of conditional denial of access is really supposed to be unconstitutional, right? The idea that we're not going to give you access to what otherwise is a public forum because we disagree with the content of your film. But the problem is, of course, if they tell you no and they tell you no, two or three no's does not suddenly grant you legal rights to go in and film in violation of the credentialing regulations on Congress. There's a lot of deference to security. There's a lot of deference to literally the physical security of the participants in the room. And so if you're told no a couple of times and you're asked to film, you're not going to be able to respond by saying, well, I asked repeatedly and they told me no, right? That having been said, I think we were talking about it beforehand, and I think for a filmmaker like Fox, this is a badge of honor, really. I think he went in knowing fully well he'd probably be either removed or arrested. And I would imagine at some point they turned the cameras on themselves, and I imagine it will appear in Gasland 2, and it'll be a great clip.
Well, Margaret, one of the things that we, you know, we don't often talk about very much is documentaries, in some documentaries, are meant to be persuasive. Some are meant to be, you know, more informative or biographical or whatever. But Gasland 1 certainly did have a point of view. So I sort of want to ask, I mean, from your point of view of looking at persuasive messages a lot, Josh Fox, other documentarians, do they get to be journalists? Do they have to come in credentialed as strategic communications professionals? I mean, how should we look at this? Forget a minute how Congress looked at it.
Well, I have a controversial viewpoint that all human communication is persuasive, whether it's news, whether it's documentary. It is not simply filming things as they happen. It is an interpretation with a desire to have an effect, credibility. In the case of investigative journalism, that is a clearly persuasive event to point out what's wrong. Evildoers should be brought to task. Bad practices should be exposed. I think that's a noble thing. Doesn't mean it's not factual. Doesn't mean it's not real. But it is meant to get something to happen. It's meant to get a reaction. And the best documentary films do precisely that, even if they're biographical and not so clearly persuasive and sort of investigative as Gasland was.
Well, Charles, I mean, this kind of brings us down to, in some ways, who's a journalist. Also, to me, it brings down to who's a citizen. I mean, Fox is a documentarian. He asked to be credentialed as a journalist, but he's also a citizen. Can't he just go in to Congress, or are we long past that sort of naive assertion?
No, I mean, he could have been in the hearing, just not with a big camera. and he wanted to be in there with a camera. I mean, I don't think the guy was real interested in sitting in the back and taking notes, right? That having been said, I think there's a really interesting genre distinction between a lot of sort of straight-up journalism and documentary film. I think documentary film as a genre has more leeway to move at things with perspective, and I don't know why. It's just an evolutionary trend. It's just happened over the years. It gives people a canvas. I think of it many ways as sort of combining the news and opinion section of your daily newspaper into one work. It just has more leeway to opine. And the audience is perfectly comfortable with that because that's the way the medium has evolved. I don't disagree with Margaret a bit. I think the academic term is social construction of reality, right? We're bringing messages to everything we do. It's particularly as communicators. I mean, his selection of that hearing to be included in that film was about three or four different decisions that all started from a point of view.
And the selection of the topic in the first place.
Yes. That said, though, I think that Congress's refusal to allow a filmmaker who clearly has an interest and an expertise in the subject to film is reprehensible. And he should call him out on it, and I have no doubt that he will.
Well, if you go on our blog, we've got a number of stories about it. But I think the thing that most startled me, and he may not have been completely prepared for, I think he was utterly prepared to be ushered out. I don't think he was prepared to be arrested. And at least of the things that I read, what was said is arrest is very unusual, and usually to somebody who's making some sort of a physical threat, as opposed to just being there with a camera in what is otherwise a public forum. So, I mean, Charles, do you think we can expect more of this, or is this kind of a one-off? It's just because of the nature of the topic, or?
Oh, no, I think this is Congress sort of flexing its muscle. I mean, if anyone, regardless of topic, tone, point of view, I don't care if it's a documentary filmmaker or a Tea Party activist, came in with a camera and was not credentialed to be in there, they're going to get arrested because Congress is not going to bend on that one bit because it's a legislative prerogative they have. It's a power they control, and I think they feel very threatened if people flout the rules. And some of that is quite legitimate because there are legitimate security concerns with uncredentialed people in Senate and House galleries. Now, I do think it'd be a fascinating social experiment to have a fracking company come in with a camera and say, "We just want to we want to use this for some promotional vehicle that we're going to do." And I wonder if they would have been arrested.
I'm gonna leave that question hanging out there, because in the little bit of time that we have remaining, I want to talk about President Obama's U-turn of earlier this week, namely him saying that, okay, I too am going to have a super PAC, because in fact it's impossible to fight super PAC money on the GOP side without super PAC money on the Democratic side. And we've done a lot of whacking away at the Citizens United decision. So I want to begin a little bit differently by saying, Margaret, what is the month of October going to be like on my television set? And like, should I move to another state?
No, you're going to have to move to another country.
That's doable.
The things will be so awash in super PAC money that you will have a constant barrage of negative ads, and they will be negative ads. Sadly enough, negative ads work. By the way, this makes local television and national television very, very happy. They're going to be awash in money too. But I don't think a tipping point has come yet with negative campaigning, and as I said, it works. It is really terrible. And I did mention to Lee earlier, if you want to find one of the worst negative ads of all time, it dates from 1964, when LBJ got an ran an ad that featured the head of the Alabama KKK endorsing Goldwater in the most horrible racist terms. So that's a pretty bleak ad.
Charles?
And then you had that nuclear annihilation Daisy ad. It's got a long checkered history in the United States.
I was going to say, it has a long and distinguished history in the United States. So is this just going to be more in terms of quantity, or do you think it's going to be qualitatively distinct? Because some of what I've read about the especially the Republican fight, particularly in South Carolina, and I went and looked at some of those ads, they were pretty awful. I mean, even by my standards, which are quite low.
I mean, from the Obama side, it'd be hard to imagine sort of unbelievably – I mean, I can't see a Mitt Romney Mormonism ad coming out of the Obama campaign. That having been said, really dumb strategic blunder, I think, by the Obama team, which was to pin yourself in a corner by making a public pronouncement about something you didn't even know the contours of yet, which is, we're not going to take super PAC, and we're not going to build a super PAC, and we won't recognize – that was dumb, frankly, because when the other side comes in with $500 million, you have absolutely no choice. And then you start getting this sort of logical gymnastics with people where you're like, well, you have to understand, we can't change the rules if we don't play the game and win. So we have to play the game and win as the rules are currently constituted so we can change the rules. And people are like, huh? Because that's a pretty complex message to the electorate.
Well, I guess I think that all the candidates, and I'm going to include President Obama in this, have said things that are going to be the kernel of profoundly negative advertising, advertising that I don't think you're going to have to move very far to say that's racist, that's anti-Mormon, that's anti-business, that's anti-government. I mean, put in any anti, and I think you'll get it.
Anti-fact, you will find a lot of those as well.
Well, as usual, we've run out of time before we went out of wisecracks. I'd like to thank my courageous panelists, Charles Davis and Margaret Duffy, for their insight and wit. Audio engineer Pat Akers for making us sound good. Technical director Travis McMillan for his willingness to help in multiple ways. And Chelsea Myers for her dazzling prompter abilities. And although we like to say it a lot, I'd also like to encourage listeners and viewers to take a look at the background information on our blog. Regular host Mike McKean will return next week. Until then, for Margaret, Charles, and me, have a wonderful evening. This is Lee Wilkins for Views of the News.